And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Drew Hardesty. Hi, Drew.
Hey, morning, Leslie. Beautiful day out there. We really needed this storm over the weekend, and not surprisingly, it was enough to tip the balance for a number of natural avalanches that some of them stepped to the ground 3 to 4 feet deep, most likely on Sunday during the peak of the storm. And in the last couple of days, there have been some significant human-triggered avalanches. Really made us stand up and take notice. These were in the periphery of sort of the snowbird backcountry, we'll call it Upper American Fork Canyon, just to the south there. These were easterly facing slopes around 9,800 feet. One was a skier remote. It was about 2 feet deep, 200 feet wide. This was triggered again at a distance about 100 feet away from the skier. Just up canyon in what we call Major Evans Gulch. This is just on the other side of Mary Ellen, again, also in Upper American Fork Canyon. This is northeast facing, 9,800 feet. This is a snowmobile-triggered avalanche that was really 2 to 4 feet deep and about 500 feet wide. Amazingly, Leslie, one of our forecasters, Trent Meisenheimer, also happened to be in the area and caught the entirety on film. The snowmobiler had his airbag deployed, ended up on top. The airbag he bought last week, so that was good luck. But, again, some close calls occurring yesterday. These are going to be increasingly stubborn to be triggered, but may still be found in isolated terrain. And even those leaving the canyons for the backcountry may also find that certain terrain, generally on west to north to southeast facing slopes above about 9,000 feet, are going to be most suspect. We're along the upper end of moderate danger for these human-triggered slides, 2 to 4 feet deep, and the danger may rise towards considerable with sunny skies, daytime heating. So have folks who don't overstay their welcome on those steep, sunny aspects. So I wouldn't be surprised to see another close call today, Leslie, and we'll be on the phone with you to talk about it tomorrow morning. So thanks so much.
Okay. Well, the Park City Board of Education met yesterday. Lots of issues have been raised. One of those due to a statement that the district put out, a statement on the planned March 14th student walkout, as well as some of the implications they learned based on the training that the board received with regard to open meetings and grammar requests in the studio to tackle some of those issues. I've got School Board President Andrew Kaplan. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the statement that the school district released yesterday concerning student walkouts, one being planned for March 14th. And I guess what is it that the district would like parents and students to know if they are considering planning to walk out of the classroom at 10 a.m.?
Well, it's obviously a nationwide movement. You know, I think our primary concern is that students remain safe. If they're planning on, you know, exercising their constitutional right to protest. You know, I believe the message from the district is to that effect, which is, you know, we want it to be organized, we want it to be peaceful, and we want to keep all of our students safe. So, you know, I think this is something that's going to be happening at our school, at other schools across the state, and at a lot of schools around the country.
And I guess I need to be clear because there was, I don't know, you told me that you hadn't seen the number of comments posted on the newsroom, mm-hmm. but there's probably 80 of them
okay.
there. And part of that is that this is for students only. It's not a, you know, parents aren't going to be there. But in terms of safety, mm-hmm. what are we doing to ensure that there is safety? I mean, now we've got a large group of students standing outside.
Yeah, so, it's more of an administrative issue than a school board issue. But what I do know is that we're partnering with the police department to ensure the safety. And I'm not sure at the building level what's happening with regards to teachers and administrative involvement. But, this is something that I think is, you know, the safety of our students and school shootings is something that's near and dear to all of our hearts. And I know there's a community-wide protest or rally, I should say, coming up, you know, also in a couple weeks. And, I think with all of these things, we we want to assume good intent and we want to assume the best, and that these will, you know, these rallies will remain peaceful. And but we will partner with, you know, with local law enforcement to ensure safety for the children. You know, obviously, when students are in the building, it's a lot easier to keep them safe. But you know, this is their and all citizens' right to peacefully protest.
Well, I want to get back to that about, because there was some concern about whether or not this really is a protected right. But the public school system is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization and mm-hmm. not allowed to support political agendas. Some parents concerned that this walkout is one that supports gun control. So that's taking a political stance. And it's not mm-hmm. it's not about student safety. It's about gun control. So do we need to reconsider this?
Well, you know, I think the law is clear in that the district and the district's employees are not allowed to take a political view, but that does not preclude students from taking a political view and exercising their political freedoms to express those views. And that, I think that's the key distinction, is that this is not something that is supported by the district per se. It's not something that the teachers have requested, or the administration has requested, or the school board has requested. This is a student-led event, and you know, we respect the students' wishes and rights, and our job is to keep them safe. It's not to decide whether or not the reasons for the march are, you know, are politically viable or correct or any of that. So it's, you know, to be clear, no one in the district is taking a political stance on gun control or anything like that. I think we're respecting students' rights and you know, their right to take a view.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, would we see a similar statement come out from the district if students decided that they wanted to do a walkout in support of the Second Amendment?
Yeah, and we've, you know, look, we had, you know, we had another, not necessarily a walkout, but kind of a rally of sorts last spring. I don't know if you remember when there was some graffiti, some racially charged graffiti at the Aspen Villas across from the high school. And we had a number of students and, you know, out in the parking lot and painting their cars and showing support for their classmates. And, you know, again, it's no different to this. I mean, you know, we have students rallying behind causes that they support. And that is, you know, in my view, that's totally okay. Where the line is drawn, obviously, is that that's not a it's not a message coming from the school, right, or the school's employees, which are funded by tax dollars, but rather it's something coming from the students. And that's the key distinction. So, you know, again, I haven't read the comments, and, you know, we're a non-political entity, you know. More, you know, we're less political than, you know, than even the state. You know, we don't have political parties in terms of our affiliation or anything like that. So this is not about gun control. This is about, you know, student safety and their right to rally peacefully. So
yeah, and certainly without the benefit of reading the comments. So I just wanted to bring one up because this sounded like this guy knew what he was talking about, or she knew what she was talking about. Commenting referred to a Supreme Court case, Tinker versus the Des Moines School District, that ruled that walking out is not a constitutional guarantee of freedom of speech when it disrupts classwork or involves disorder on the rights of others. So again, we've got, you know, the district saying that we want to, you know, support students' constitutional rights, and yet this Supreme Court case says that when you disrupt the classroom, that's not a constitutional right.
You know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know exactly what the, you know, what the legal precedent is. The advice we've gotten has been that it is a right. You know, I'm happy to check with our, you know, with our counsel and see if that's not in fact the case. But given the, you know, what I've read in the press and what I think everyone has seen is that this is happening across the country, and I would be hesitant to assume that it is not allowed, given how widespread it is. But I, you know, that's a valid point, and I'm happy to, you know, to refer that to our counsel and see, you know, what their view is on that.
Yeah, and any concern that if students are taking a political stance on this, that they, and we'll be talking to the students actually on Friday, so I'll get a better understanding about what they really think about what they're trying to accomplish. But there was some concern, I think, from parents that if students didn't participate and instead decided to stay in the classroom, that they would somehow be bullied in the fact that they, they're not taking a stand against gun control or something.
Look, I think it's hard being an adolescent. I mean, I remember my own adolescence was very difficult. I think it's hard being a high school student in this day and age. And, you know, this is just one of the many things that causes anxiety. You know, the fact that, unfortunately, kids have to worry about their safety when they're at school, which should be a place of paramount safety, and that they, you know, they can focus solely on learning. And if I was a student right now, I would be upset at the state of affairs. And, you know, as a parent, I think it's a shame that we have to, you know, resort to increased security measures and be concerned about gun violence in our schools. But again, that's not a, you know, a comment on gun control per se. I think it's about people's right to a free and safe education, which is the, you know, the two key tenets of public education in our country. And when one of those isn't being met, when one of those isn't being met, namely the safe part of the education, I think people have a right to be angry. Now, whether or not the solution for that is, you know, increased mental health initiatives, which, you know, I think as a district we support, or whether that's a comment on gun control, you know, that's not for us to decide. I think, you know, what is relevant is that we're looking at both increased mental health initiatives in our school, and it's been a focus of this board, as well as, you know, increasing safety for our facilities. And that's also been a focus for our board this year and for our administration. So we're, you know, as a district, we are taking both of these angles that have been heavily politicized very, very seriously. We're looking at both angles. We're spending and investing a lot of money and time and resource into both of them, and we'll continue to. So it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's about the kids being safe and learning. And, you know, we're going to look at all angles. And this isn't about national politics or gun control or Second Amendment or any of that. So,
well, let's let that lead into when you talk about all of the efforts that we've made towards student mental mm-hmm. wellness. Let that lead into the discussion that the board had centered around Tier 3 students, mm-hmm. some concerns that you expressed with the elementary schools perhaps not having enough staff to provide intervention with reading, language arts, and math. Can you kind of detail some of those concerns?
Sure. So one of the line items on the budget proposal this year was an increase in 4 headcounts for interventionists, basically one at every elementary school. And when we first, we've been looking at the budget for about 6 weeks along with the administration. And 4 weeks ago, so 2 meetings ago, we asked the administration for some data around Tier 3 learners. And so what we're talking about is, you know, Tier 1 is kind of general learning. Tier 2 is a second dose of what's typical in the classroom for, you know, for students who aren't getting it the first time around. And then there's Tier 3, which are, you know, you hear it once, you don't get it. You hear it twice, you don't get it. Tier 3 is the kids who don't get it the second time, and they need a different type of learning. And all kids learn differently, whether that's reading, whether it's writing, whether it's math. It's, you know, it depends. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. And the ask from administration is for 4 new interventionists. And the ask back from the board has been, okay, show us the data of how many kids in each grade are quote unquote Tier 3 learners and who needs the resource and what resources are currently being provided so that we can understand, okay, what are those interventionist needs? And specifically beyond the headcount, what does their expertise need to be, right? Because what the ask is of the administration is for them to be reading specialists, essentially, to be, you know, Orton-Gillingham trained, Wilson Foundations, you know, specialists, where, you know, Bob Edmonston, you know, spoke very eloquently about the needs at McPolin, and he has been asking for an additional interventionist for quite some time. But he also stated that, you know, about 130 of his kids are ELL, English language learners. And we know that for English language learners, Wilson isn't necessarily the right answer. And so I think what the board wants to see is, okay, what specifically are the needs? Do we have a need for interventionists on language acquisition? Do we have a need for interventionists on reading? Do we have a need for interventionists in other subjects? And I think the board is very willing to provide all of those, right? So the answer may not be 4. The answer may be over time, it's more than 4. But I think what we need to see is the data from administration so that we can justify the expense. And that's just being responsible for tax dollars, right, as opposed to just saying, okay, you can have whoever you need. And part of that as well is that we want to have some kind of district-wide standards for these positions and these roles, as opposed to just kind of hiring them ad hoc and putting them into buildings to plug holes.
Yeah, the district has eliminated reading aids in recent years and replaced that system with what you kind of mentioned, this Wilson method, the PLI program. So did we make a mistake there? Should we have just left? I mean, is that why we're seeing the need now?
No, I don't think it's necessary. That's necessarily the case. We're moving towards a system called MTSS, which is multi-tiered systems of support. And the general concept is to put more knowledge in the hands of the teachers. So expand their toolbox and put more into the classroom. So you have less pullout of children where they're missing the instructional time with the teacher, and having the teachers have more skills and all of that. But that's a very lengthy process, and it takes a lot of time to train all the teachers in all of these different skill sets. And so, you know, that could take, you know, in the idea, you know, in the words of Dr. Belknap and Julie Hastings, that could take 5 years to get all of our teachers in the district, you know, up and running. And so what we have is we have this transition where, yes, we're trying to give teachers, you know, more training and more skills to identify issues in the classroom. But in the meantime, you know, we have kids who are struggling who need more support. And it's kind of that balance is you don't necessarily want to hire an army of people to plug holes. You want to make a system that's sustainable over the long term. But in the meantime, you have to kind of triage the issues that exist today. And that's where we are. And that's, you know, the dilemma that we struggle with.
Yeah. And just to counter that way, I mean, we have spent a lot of money in the last year beefing up on our wellness staffing, more, in fact, being proposed. And just we're talking about just 7 teachers. So have we, you know, in our attempt to meet the wellness needs, mental wellness needs, are we losing it on the education side of things?
No, I don't think so. I think we, you know, we continue to be a very highly functioning district. We continue to, you know, be operating at a very high standard. I think we're, you know, we're blessed in that we don't have an explicit resource shortage. And so there's really no excuse for an achievement gap. There's really no excuse for kids who are struggling from a resource perspective. And so that's what we're dealing with is it's not, okay, do we have the money? It's how do we allocate the money most effectively so that we can help all children and provide equity for our children. And you know, both of those are valid expenses in the board's mind and in the administration's mind. It's just finding that right balance, and that takes some time.
So when we talk about the tier three, do we have a number on that, or that's what you're asking
for?
That's
what we're asking for, right? I mean, you know, we have you know, in terms of PC Reads, which is a local nonprofit that supports children with reading issues, you know, they have several hundred members, I believe. And so, you know, that's, I don't know, 5 to 8% of our students in the district, you know, with a reading issue. We have a very high number of students in our district with a language acquisition issue. And so, you know, I don't know what the numbers are. I would say it's probably somewhere like a fifth of our district. You know, well, probably 15 to 20% of our kids have some struggle with some aspect of learning. And that's not atypical nationwide. That's just, you know, what we're looking at. And it's how do we provide resources for all those kids so that they, you know, we can meet their needs.
Wanted to get to start times. This was, again, discussed as part of the budget discussion, whether or not we buy buses and hire bus drivers. Let's talk just briefly, though. The majority of students now are saying that they oppose later start times, and I think the majority of teachers do, too. Not a huge majority. I mean, we're talking 51, 56% maybe.
Yeah.
So what do you guys do? I mean, because
it's a really tough one, Leslie. Look, the science is clear that adolescents need more sleep. They go to bed later. They wake up later. We are, you know, continuing as a district to try to find a solution that benefits them, but doesn't disadvantage everyone else in the district. But not only that, you know, we have a very active community in terms of our high school, in terms of extracurriculars. And there's impacts when and a lot of the pushback we've gotten from parents and students in the high school has been, well, if we start later, what happens to our sports, to our band, to our art, to our drama? You know, what happens to those activities, and there aren't enough hours in the day? And I think we have to just be very creative, specifically around the high school schedule, about, okay, if this is something that is an interest of the majority in the high school, whether it's the majority of parents, students, you know, educators, et cetera, or it's, you know, even if it's half of our students and parents want this, how do we offer the option for these kids so that we, but it, so that it doesn't disrupt everyone else? And that is both, when I'm talking about disruption, I'm talking about the 2,400 elementary school kids we have in our district, as well as the other kids in high school who are happy with the schedule and happy, you know, waking up when they do. And other districts have looked at, you know, not having a block schedule, but having seven periods in the day. And, you know, for people who are doing athletics or after school, their last period is allocated to those. And for, you know, other people, they can take that first period off, which is similar to the early release that we currently have. And so I think what we need to do over the next several months is look at, do that exercise and look at what would it take to change our scheduling, and would that meet the needs of the students and parents who want their children to start later.
Yeah. I mean, what we do have those parent releases, right? That people can sign up for them.
Yes.
But I think the problem is then how do some of those students get to school?
Correct. And that's, so there's, I mean, there's so many different kind of layers to this. There's the transportation layer. There's the aftercare layer for the students who provide aftercare for their siblings. There's, you know, there's so many different things that are affected. And so, you know, this is a, it's an ongoing process that continues to meet roadblocks, whether it's, you know, traffic on 248, whether it's after school activities. And we're going to continue to work on it because we think that it's an initiative that will help with mental health in their district. But, you know, I think there is some, there's legitimate anxiety, and there's, because there's some misinformation out there that we are changing this fall. We have a motion on the table that existed since last spring, which was to explore the feasibility of changing within a very specific time frame. Some of the numbers or the times that are being, you know, sent around now and that are on some of the social media sites are not necessarily correct. What we're going to discuss in 2 weeks' time at our meeting is, okay, specifically, is there a way to adjust start times for the high school or for all schools in a moderate sense? So a 15, 20 minute bump later, what would that mean for after school activities? What would that mean for everything? That's a proposal that's come to us from some of the folks on the start time committee, and we're going to explore that through our administration. But in terms of a widespread schedule change that affects the entire district for this fall, we just don't have enough time to implement that. And that's not, you know, that's something that, you know, I don't think is physically possible for us to do. So we're going to have a vote on it. You know, the board will get together with administration and see what's feasible, and we'll make an assessment. But, you know, the schedules for the high school are already done. So our ability to change start times for the high school or for other schools, you know, a lot of the daycare commitments and things like that for our younger students are already booked and scheduled as well. It's, you know, in order to do this, we would have to start now and take the next year to get it so that when the schedules come out next January, we'd be ready to go.
Okay. Real quick. I just wanted to get a couple of others.
Sure.
The school board received training on open meetings and grammar requests. What you heard with regard to the superintendent applications is that the public interest, these are public records, and the public interest in disclosure outweighs the privacy interest of the candidate, which contradicts what your recruiter has told you. So what do you guys do here?
Well, I think what's at debate legally is when someone applies and they, you know, submit their resume, is that a public record? And obviously, there's a lot of folks out there who we may be recruiting for this role whose privacy is important to them because they may be in a current position where they don't want their community to find out. And so I think it's kind of a gray area, and it depends on what stage in the process they're in, right? I think that if they were to send an application to a recruiter or talk to a recruiter, I don't think that becomes a public document. I think when they become interviewed officially, then that starts to get to the point where, you know, we've seen their resumes, we have them electronically, things like that. And so we're going to continue to work with our legal counsel to make sure that the privacy of our candidates is protected to the extent we can. And I think, you know, there's an issue, and there was a case in or a grammar request in another district in Utah recently where the state records board decided in favor of or against the school district in terms of trying to keep those candidates, information private. So, we're going to continue to look at that. The good news is our recruiting for a new superintendent is going extremely well. We have quite a few kind of, incoming applications, as well as, a huge number that's been identified by our recruiter and that are starting to, our recruiter is starting to have conversations with a rather lengthy list of very impressive candidates. So as a board, we're very happy with the process. Next steps, we'll have we're going to send out an invitation for people to apply to be involved in the interview process from a community and a staff perspective. The first round of interviews is likely to be, I believe, April 16th to 18th, so in a little more than a month's time. And then final round will be approximately a month after that, May 12th, at which point we'll make a hire.
And when will you announce the new high school principal?
So the interviews are taking place on Friday. And we'll see how that process goes with the interview committee.
Okay. Need to leave it there, Andrew. Thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Park City School Board President Andrew Kaplan. Park City Council meeting and work session Thursday starting at 4 o'clock at the City Council Chambers. In the studio with a preview, I have City Manager Diane Foster along with Community Development Director Anne Laurent. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Diane, at 4:15, a McPolin Farm update. Are we talking about allowing more uses there, or what's being discussed?
So, yes, absolutely. So one of the things is just to give Council an update on where we are. There have been a lot of structural improvements. There was a project that was a little bit over $1 million to, I think as a community icon, it's one of those that no one wants it to fall down. And also there's the fire suppression had been upgraded a few years ago. The question, as you raised, about should we have more uses, that is absolutely a question for Council, and that's why we're doing this as a work session. There's been an interest in providing school group tours. I went to the last year to the Your Barn Door is Open event, and going upstairs and seeing Torch and Sally Elliott dance as the sunlight came through it's not an insulated barn, so came through the wood slats of the barn. It was beautiful, and people being able to see that in our history and culture is it's important.
So we'll have some answers then, or just a work session? It would have to come back and be
so it's actually a question. There is a conditional use permit on that barn, and also the parking over there is difficult. A lot of times when photography season starts, especially in the spring, you see people parking along the road, and that's pretty unsafe, especially since we now do have the ability in traffic to drive buses in the breakdown lane. Now they're not going so fast that we have a real safety issue there, but we do want people to park on the other side of the street. However, that's also trailhead parking. So we do have some issues there, and the events that right now you can have 6 events at the barn, and the city is the sponsor for those events. And when we run events, we typically have people park at the mark and we bus them over from there.
So we're talking about just keeping to city events or opening it to weddings? And
That's been a discussion of the Friends of the Farm Board. There's generally been a concern about that can be a lot of impact. Now, there's also the flip side of that could raise a lot of money as well, right? You could say, let's have $400,000 weddings a year, and would that help pay for the upkeep of the barn? I think right now the Friends of the Farm Board is of the opinion that they don't want those kind of impacts, and especially it is a community and icon, and you want to be able to ride your bike over there and go have a picnic and those kind of things. So I think what they're talking about right now is the ability to bring people there to see it and learn the history and the McPolin family as well as the Osgathorpe family.
Okay, 5 o'clock, and the Lower Park Avenue affordable housing options for Woodside Park Phase 2 will be discussed. So what are we talking about in terms of options here?
So this is just an initial conversation to show some design concepts and get some early input. And we're talking about, 48-ish units and a little bit higher density than Woodside Phase 1 as you move closer towards the resort, because it's between Woodside and Empire. And we just are looking for some thoughts before we get too far down the road on design.
All right. Are we talking tall apartment kind of buildings or what?
No,
underground parking, or
we're still working with the 35 feet above finished grade, so we're still working within the code. And so it's just, it's a slope site, so it does step up the hill, so it might look a little bit taller than maybe something, a building that was on a flat site, because there's a series of buildings that step up.
So these would be for sale units?
That's the plan right now, and we're looking at everything from 80% AMI all the way up to 150% AMI, primarily because this project's within the RDA, and we're not bound to only affordable. We can also look at attainable level and even market rate if we wanted to.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's a discussion in terms of what we build, studio, 1, 2, 3 bedroom?
Correct. I think from a staff perspective, we're still supporting, and the market supports a mix of units and not too much of any one type. So we're still going to look for the mix, but certainly every time we do a project, we try to inform the next one as to what people can afford and also what people are looking for. They don't always match, but we do our best.
Okay. And then again, with trying to put in the density there, where is the parking, or is there parking?
Oh, there absolutely is parking. It's a combination. We're looking at a stack flat type of structure that's entered off of Empire with parking underneath it. And then we're looking at townhomes that would actually have a garage, a one-car garage. And then there are some surface type few, but we tried not to take up too much of the site with parking.
Yeah. And then with the first phase, we had some of the units with lockouts. Would we do that for this phase or no?
Not sure. I mean, we're definitely looking at units and trying to incorporate some smaller type units, but no, we're not locked into anything at this point.
All right. Let's talk real quickly about the Alice Claim development. That's back. This is an ongoing project. So a public hearing and action. We're ready to allow this to get under construction?
That's correct. It's a return of both a subdivision and a plat amendment. It was approved by the Planning Commission last year, and it came back to the council. And then they had some concerns, and they sent it back. So we're back to address those concerns, primarily around utilities and construction mitigations, items of that nature. And so staff's going to present what they've come up with.
Okay. And we've got a plat mat now that basically does away with any of those huge, tall retaining walls?
Correct. That's no longer part of it. They're going to access it through another parcel that they were able to get that agreement in place.
Okay. And that was key, right, to get that?
That certainly was key to that particular issue, absolutely.
Okay. Any other outstanding issues with that?
No, I don't think so. I think, again, we're just going to, it's an ongoing conversation, so I think people are going to, but we also have some new counselors, so they may have some questions.
Also, the proposed mountaintop annexation, this is there near Quarry Mountain. It's currently in unincorporated Summit County. Why are we talking about bringing it into Park City now?
So our process allows people to request an annexation. So we received an application, and we have some requirements to process it and then consider whether or not to accept it or not accept it within a certain amount of time. And so that's where we are at this point. It's not it wouldn't be approving the annexation. It's just considering whether or not we want to further consider it.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a recommendation from your staff?
At this point, the staff recommendation is not to accept it, primarily because of the there's not a financial plan in place to deal with some of the utility challenges they have. It's quite complex, and for the size of the subdivision, it's quite pricey. And we think that there needs to be more work done on that before we start spending a lot of time dealing with all the other aspects of it. There are some reasons to consider annexation. It is access through our roads, and it is contiguous to our other subdivisions in the community, and it would allow us some future regulatory control that we may want to consider. So but we just think that there's these bigger issues. So what we're saying is, if these financial issues can be taken care of, it could be reconsidered.
So we're talking what, water and sewer specifically, or is it on sewer?
It's primarily water is the main concern, right?
That they don't have the water, or
right, they don't have adequate water pressure for fighting fires and even just day to day operations in their homes right now.
Okay, so with that recommendation, the council will decide whether or not they move forward with it. If it's no, they can do more work. The applicants could do more work and come back at a later time.
Correct.
All right, Diane wanted to ask you about the emergency contract for a professional services agreement for Ward Engineering Group. What's the emergency?
The emergency was Treasure Hill. So as you know, Ann Laurent, who's sitting with me, as well as City Engineer Matt Castle, Planning Director Bruce Erickson, Francisco Astorga, Dave Thacker, and Alfred Knotts pretty much skipped Christmas, and they all worked over the holidays. And so they needed Ward Engineering was the firm that was doing – that had the software and some of the technology that we needed to do the road assessments up on Treasure and to find a – to find a road that could meet the grade requirements. And this is when the half density proposal was being considered. So that was one we needed. We needed Matt to go down to Ward Engineering. And I remember being in a conference call with him on Martin Luther King Day, and he's down at Ward Engineering. And so we needed to do that quickly, and our code provides for that. And so we now bring it back to council and say, hey, everybody knew about this, right? Internally, everybody was aware and said, hey, we're going to move forward with this. We don't want to wait because of the timetable. And so we're just bringing that back.
Okay, so how much is the contract for? It's an outstanding bill at this point, right?
That's the landscaping.
It's 40, just below 44,000.
Okay. All right, so the work's been done.
And it was presented publicly. It was all the road on the work and mm-hmm. the grades and how it could work and provide the adequate access for what was being considered at the time. And it was also tied to a settlement agreement, and some of those time frames were beyond the city's control that we were having to meet.
I guess so. It's coming to councils because of the amount, and it needs council approval?
It's coming to the council for just full transparency to make sure they're fully notified as to where we ended up and what we actually approved.
So they won't actually even vote on it as a staff communication report. But as Ann said, the public process is important to us.
There's a citywide employee safety program update. We hear so much about safety these days. What's this about?
This is an update. You know, we're not claiming causality, but there is a correlation between probably about 5 years ago, we had safety programs in individual departments, but we didn't have a citywide safety program. In some of our departments, we were actually, in the building department in particular, we were facing an OSHA fine of something like $24,000 a day. They do it on a per person, per violation type thing. So we instituted a program, avoided those fines, and we've actually had a reduction in the cost of our insurance because we've had fewer accidents. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is about people and them coming to work in one piece and going home in one piece. And we do care about employee safety.
And also a consideration to approve the Snyderville Basin Special Recreation District's trail easement across city-owned property on Iron Mountain. Is this for...
What? This is for an existing trail, and so this is some of that kind of cleanup work where we say, hey, this is a trail that the basin maintains, this part of the trail the basin maintains, and we want them to be able to have legal access to it. So it's just again, more of public process.
Is that Mid-Mountain? Is that what we're talking
that
about?
That is, yes.
And then whatever happened with the pilot program at Bonanza Flat this
That's a good question. That one is looking like it may not be able to happen just because we're still working with everything from, we really appreciate the help from the bank, Wells Fargo and Redis, as well as we're working with the Property Owners Association up at Red Cloud. And we're just working through all of that. There's a meeting this coming Monday with Wasatch County because we have to figure out emergency services. So we think at this point it's probably not going to happen, unfortunately. You will be seeing next week. I do want to let folks know we're going to be coming with the proposed uses and proposed restrictions. We expect that to be a lively public hearing. I do expect that that the city council will not want to have snowmobile uses up there.
Okay.
So that is some concern.
Another big one was dogs.
You know what? I actually have not read the report yet, so I don't know where they landed on dogs. But I know that there's been an active users group, about 13 different players on that users group that's been working on it.
All right. And then finally, just wanted to get a legislative update specifically with regard to the bill that would ban bag bans.
The bag ban. Yes, and a number of states actually have these types of bans where it says that local government can't do it. You know, we thought this was over. We thought we were going to lose our bag ban. And to our surprise, it passed in the Senate. And then to our surprise, Representative Tim Quinn has been working his colleagues. And as you heard him state on the radio, I really appreciated that interview. He said, I don't agree with banning plastic bags, but I agree with Park City's right to do it and their ability for their citizens to decide what they want. And he has been lobbying his fellow representatives in the House, and we don't it's not a, as you mentioned this morning, as Utah Policy talked about, committee hearings are over now. So if it's to be considered, it would be considered on the floor. I think our best hopes right now are, one is Representative Tim Quinn has been strongly working it. And number two, our other hope is that maybe it just doesn't make it to the floor in time. And that always happens every year with a number of bills. So we're cautiously hopeful. If it does get considered, I don't think it will. I don't think we'll have a chance, although I do want to really thank Representative Tim Quinn and also Senator Van Tassel, who is retiring. He actually has been a supporter of Park City on this one and has been lobbying as well.
Yeah. And then we know, just like equalization, it'll come back.
We do expect it would come back. And, you know, I think for, and we appreciate the help of the Utah League of Cities and Towns as well. This is a, while many towns would never consider a ban, it is a issue of local control.
Finally, do we know where it came from?
The bag ban? Matt, I'll have Matt Dias come on and talk to you about it. It was somebody down in Salt Lake. And we did at one point also have a proposal to put a 10-cent statewide tax on bags. And that's one of the most successful ways that they've seen. And, you know, the other day I was in Fresh Market and I was talking to one of the cashier supervisors and said, hey, you know, how do visitors? And it was a giant line. And she said, I said, how do visitors feel about this? She said, I don't get any comments. No one complains about it. Yeah. So I think we're in a good spot and we're hopeful.
Okay. Anne, Diane, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, coming up on Saturday night at the Park City Echo Center, it's the Trinity Irish Dance Company. On the phone with me to tell us what to expect, I have Chelsea Hoy. She's the Associate Artistic Director. Good morning to you, Chelsea.
Good morning.
So tell us what to expect. I mean, is it Irish dancing? Is it river dancing?
We are a contemporary Irish-American company. That presents Irish dancing blended with contemporary modern pedestrian forms. And I also have founding artistic director Mark Howard with me as well.
Okay. Well, hi, Mark. So,
hi, Leslie.
Yeah. So how many people in the troupe that you've got bringing with you?
I think there's 20 dancers coming to Utah, oh. Two males and 18 females, because it's primarily a female company. And we have four band members and then crew in tow.
Okay. That's interesting. Your own band members to play because it's specific music?
Well, we just always wanted to invest in live music. There's nothing like it. So we do perform to some soundtrack, but most contemporary companies tour without bands, and so it's just an added bonus to what we present on stage.
All right. Well, explain to me why the word Irish is in the name of the company.
Well, because we're this, like, really cool Irish-American contemporary dance company that was born in Chicago and Milwaukee, all of these dancers grew up competing as traditional dancers. Many of them won world championship titles. We come out of that ethnic tradition, but we push the boundaries of what's possible for that art form.
Okay. And in terms of what you're going to be performing, how many pieces?
Chelsea's lifting up her hands to say 10 pieces.
Oh, wow.
We're going to be doing a mixture of classic works, including pieces like Johnny, which was named for Johnny Carson years ago when we performed the year he retired. That piece is very much like the bedrock of what leads to progressive Irish dance, which leads to commercial reactions to that work, like River Dance. We're doing a piece called Current Event, another classic choreographed by the now head of the New York University Dance Department, Sean Curran, who was the lead dancer in Bill T. Jones's company for many years. And that's a great girl power, let their hair down, kind of Irish dance meets stomp piece. We're also doing instant classics like Communion, which mixes body percussion and Irish step dance in an integrity sort of filled way. And we just came off of a great New York run at the Joyce Theater, where the company got really favorable reviews from the New York Times, and we world premiered Souls. And Souls, Chelsea, do you want to explain what Souls is? That's, I think, going to be a really great number for the audience
yeah.
there.
Souls is a tribal and timeless rhythmic study, and it's a blend of being unafraid of silences, but also bringing the thunder. So it's the perfect example of how the Trinity Irish Dance Company celebrates Irish dancing through a performing arts blend.
Oh, great. Be exciting to have you. I know showtime is 7:30 p.m. Tickets start at $29. And people can get more information at EcclesCenter.org or calling the box office 435-655-3114. Mark and Chelsea, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.